Welcome to the Untangling Web3 podcast. We're at ETH Denver, as you can see from everything behind Kyle over there. Today, we're diving into one of Web3's biggest challenges, secure and private decentralized identity. As our digital lives expand, how do we prove who we are without compromising privacy? Joining me are two experts, well, I hope they're experts, who are shaping the future of decentralized identity. So we have Shadi Eldamadi, is the CEO and co-founder of Holonym Foundation, the leading Web3 identity platform by ZK Credentials, a former cognitive neuroscientist, a pioneer in decentralized science, love that. And we also have to my left here, Kyle Weiss, head of strategy at the Holonym Foundation, a five-time startup founder and former co-founder of Gitcoin and Passport XYZ. So, some recent news is Holonym acquired Gitcoin Passport, now called Human Passport, and has already distributed nearly $400 million to verified users, all without a token, yet. So, let's dive in. Shadi, how are you doing?
I'm good. The altitude's getting to me a little bit. I forgot my chapstick, so...
Okay. Unfortunately, I used to live in Denver, so this is almost like the homecoming event for me whenever I get to come back.
Nice.
And I'm always dried out. I'm like, oh, this is why I left a few years ago. But Denver's, the weather's been fantastic. We've been super fortunate this week.
The merch here is crazy, but I have seen loads of people giving away free chapstick, and they are the most popular stands by far.
Yes.
But yeah, we're in the middle of the conference right now. It's incredible. There's so much going on. Kyle, how are you finding ETH Denver itself?
It's been good. It's much more commercialized than it used to be. So like years in the past, it's really been focused on kind of community, core builders. This seems to have been much more just commercialized. Like these venues, the sort of booths that are set up are beautiful, but things that I would expect to see almost at like a Salesforce conference. It's been a little bit of an adjustment for me personally.
Yeah, I've noticed that as well. Like a lot of the, I've seen like there's been much more kind of content, topics, emerging technology at some of the side events, but say the main stuff is, like you say, mostly sales pitch marketing style, which is a bit new, novel.
I think there was an intention to shift it away from being an Ethereum community conference. I think it's one of the first ones, along with ECC, to becoming more of an innovation festival. I started seeing that language more and more and more. Now we're at this big venue. You know, there's all sorts of crazy stuff, video games and like all sorts of gimmicks, and that's great. But that also invites a lot of, I think, auxiliary intentions that divert us from maybe the main reason why this got started.
Right. Yep. Which to me is like all about the community. I think I've seen more interest in the robots that are walking around, these competitors to Tesla's new robot as well. And it's like, hey, like, are you actually doing anything in this space?
One of them actually stepped on my shoe. I felt like it was intentional. Like it did one of those stomps, you know? And the guy's like, oh, sorry about that.
That's how they get you in. Yeah, you are so right. I've seen about 10 of them. My background is robotics. I go up to them and be like, what's the relation of this robot to what you're doing? There's none. It's just to pull people in. But that's marketing, right? It's funnel. That's what the point of this is.
Yeah.
Right. So we're not here to talk about ETH Denver. We're here to talk about decentralized identity. Let's start off nice and slow. Who wants to start with this one? Let's go with Shadi. Why is proving identity so important in the digital age?
That's a great question. So if we think about identity, it's something that means different things to different people. Especially, I think in Web3, there's this association of identity as being the next big killer use case, because people saw Bitcoin, it fundamentally transformed something that we all interacted with, which is money.
Mm.
And so what's next after money? We associate money with the government, we associate it with our social contract, etc. And so identity seems to be that next thing that's going to change and make things more decentralized and private and secure and trustless and etc. Now the interesting thing is identity, it's kind of a natural reaction, but identity is something that people don't go after. People need money, but they don't necessarily need a driver's license unless they want to drive.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been this, I think, jumping the gun over the past 5 to 8 years of people trying to make identity happen the same way Bitcoin happened. But in the end, it all comes down to what do you really need identity for? Now back to the question, right? So today, we're really seeing, I think, a shift of commerce, of social functions, of communities, of culture into digital spaces.
Mm.
And when that happens, we're kind of bringing all of these attributes of ourselves into these spaces, but perhaps we're not also bringing all of the other things that need to come along with it for safe and responsible use. Mm-hmm. So, for example, personhood. How do you know who's actually a person, right? Whether, and I'm talking about, like, not only are they a living, breathing human being, but also, you know, are they a legal person that's entered into a social contract, right? Mm-hmm. And so these ideas and concepts are fundamentally different when you start thinking about what social contracts look like in digital spaces versus, say, a constitutional republic.
Some of that is so much like building trust in these ecosystems as well, right? Like, identity gives you not only reputation, but it gives you this sense of like who you are and who you want to represent yourself as, that reputation can hang off of, but ultimately like trust systems and financial networks and social settings, whatever that might be. So finding ways to figure out who can participate in what capacity, I think, is another space that like identity has been super, super valuable, sort of emerging in Web3 at least.
Yeah. I like that you mentioned the idea of like it was payment rails first, like blockchain technology made sense immediately for it. All the value proposition of it is trust in data, immutability, all these things that are constantly touted. And that makes sense for currency, for payments, for this kind of stuff where you're just moving, you know, data around on a ledger. But, you know, taking it one step further, data out there is one thing. How do we apply it to useful things like people? I want to attach that data to an individual. So you see there's an immediate alignment between Web3 of currency and Web3 of identity. But then on the other side, like Bitcoin, all these things are often touted as being kind of very good for anonymity. And you think, actually, is there some kind of mismatch there? Is there a direct alignment with Web3 for identity, or is there not? And Kyle, do you want to answer that question?
Yeah, sure. So I suspect a lot of us don't want to support those that are doing evil. Like, whether it's sanctioned nations, whether you believe in those sanctions, ultimately, we want to make sure the funds are going to places that are being used appropriately, perhaps not to kill other people. So there's a lot of concepts, I think, that we can start to explore in the Web3 space around, you know, proof of clean hands. Mm-hmm. Has this person some sort of criminal background where they wouldn't be able to get a bank account previously? Now, one thing that's lovely about a lot of the space, just like blockchain in general, is it does offer payment rails for things that are in the gray area as well. So we can go through and sort of prove that someone is not on a block list, like they are passing like anti-money laundering, all without doing KYC checks. And in that particular environment, it also enables a lot of on-chain interactions where previously they might have gotten debanked.
Okay.
So in this environment, like, I think the payment rails that Bitcoin has afforded has been fantastic. Everything's on-chain, and so as soon as an identity is linked to that sort of wallet address, it's very, very difficult to ever back away from that. You have to kind of just start over. But finding ways to include those inside of your ecosystem who you know are at least real humans, and perhaps real humans who have good intention, unlocks a lot more sort of trust coordination interactions that I think is what a lot of folks are still working to solve in the blockchain space.
Yeah, are you noticing that this is like a big, say, is it a big reason that institutions have taken their time getting into, say, the Bitcoin space? Is because of the anonymity and the lack of KYC involved? Is that something you guys have both noticed?
Yeah, it's interesting. So, you know, when you, coming back to payment rails, when we really look at crypto, it's an excellent tool for capital flow. Mm. And capital flow, I think, in the current world we live in today, it's the difference between a good idea in theory and something put into practice. Capital will help ideas thrive, they'll help them grow and accomplish things. Now, in the institutional setting, people are looking at crypto rails and they're like, wow, this is an incredible way to get value into as many hands as possible, to deploy capital, to grow the economy, to bring more people into the marketplace. But they're also looking at it with suspicion. They're saying, okay, wait, I can circulate capital to anyone, anywhere, and with capital comes power. So identity is one of those things that's an actual requirement for any large-scale distribution of capital, and this is something we see with airdrops. Projects want to be able to, say, get their memetics, get their tokenized value of whatever abstract idea they're selling with their token, and they want to get it into as many hands as possible.
Well, I mean, ultimately, a lot of that started with governance, right? It's like we want to turn over power of this thing to the people that are using it themselves. And so airdrops started, you know, early on days as like governance tokens, and this approach that not only are we rewarding you for the efforts of participating in our ecosystem, but we actually want you to help make decisions with us as well. And so I think once once we've had the chance to sort of go through and say, you know, A, how many people do you actually want to distribute and push that to? And B, how do you make sure that there's real humans that you're allocating that to so that those decisions are getting made in a way that actually benefits the community and not just a couple whale actors that are perhaps acting on behalf of their own self-interest instead of the community's interest?
Yeah, and this is a challenge that's maybe quite unique to, you know, proving identity in the digital age. Like when you go to a traditional bank, you go there, I prove who I am. So there's no real problem with people spamming up 100 versions of me overnight, pretending to be 100 different people. But when we're talking the digital age, proving that, the convenience comes at a lack of trust and security potentially. And I guess we're going to talk about it a bit later, but like you say, airdrops is a great example. The convenience of being able to send money anywhere very quickly also means there's a downside of who you're sending that money to. Like those 100 people could be the same person all getting the money very efficiently. And that's not ideal, especially when you're talking about the governance. Are these airdrops going to the right people? Are they real people? Which matters more than, you know, the convenience in some cases. So we kind of talked about the problem a little bit. Can you explain Holonym and where it fits into all this? How does it fix this Web3 identity problem we're having?
Yeah, absolutely. I can give a stab at that. So yes, so Holonym builds keys, wallets, and identity. At the very base foundation, we have something called the human network, which props up this whole human tech or human-aligned technology ecosystem that we're creating. The human network lets you take human data, like what you have, what you know, what you are, and create a human key with it. It's a key that's very difficult to lose because it's tied to attributes or a combination of attributes. So for example, you could we have like a little fun demo where you can do a biometric face scan and authenticate and create a wallet with that, which is kind of cool. And there's some very specific use cases for that we have in mind. But once you have this key, I mean, that's the big challenge in crypto self-custody is how do you actually allow people to be in control of their own assets, property, data, identity, etc.? Well, you need to give them self-custody. You need to give it to them in a way where that key is persistent. So this network exists kind of as a persistent key availability system or protocol where you can just pull your key from this decentralized network at any point and then interact with crypto. You can, you know, interact with Bitcoin. You can even perhaps send end-to-end encrypted messages if that's what you're doing with that. So that's our foundation. We've built a couple demonstrations or applied use cases to solve other problems. One of them is the human passport, which allows you to prove personhood. We like to call it sometimes modular personhood. There's many ways to prove who you are. Very low barrier to entry. And then we also have an embeddable wallet, EVM wallet, that has some pretty cool features. That's called the human wallet.
Okay. So I think that is really interesting, the idea of, you know, how to create a private key from something. Everyone's in the crypto space anyway is familiar with mnemonics, which has probably been one of the bugbears of getting, you know, giant Web2 adoption and whatnot. And the idea of linking your intrinsic attributes to your key so you don't have potentially that mnemonic problem. But as soon as you say something like, oh, biometrics going on chain, all this kind of stuff, what is the feedback there? Is it something where, you know, there's someone who's actually understanding my very private face scan or my blood potentially, all this kind of stuff? Is this something you get questioned on a lot?
I haven't, actually.
Oh, really?
This is like my one-liner. It's like, oh, what do you guys do? Oh, we make wallets from biometrics. And people are like, oh, that's pretty cool. Like, that's pretty cool stuff. And maybe people are just being polite. I don't know.
Yeah. I think a lot of the approach that we've taken, perhaps on the passport side and why we've combined a lot of passport with Holonym, is because there's no one right way to prove that you're a unique human. There's a gentleman named Brian Ford who's done a bunch of research in the US on digital identity systems and voting systems. And some of that research has shown that there's kind of four key ways to prove that you're a unique human. The easiest is obviously showing up in person for verification.
Yeah.
The second is usually biometrics. So we have others that are scanning palms, scanning faces, scanning irises. The third is like a social or web of trust. Like if Shadi says that someone's human and I trust Shadi, then I can believe that they're real. And so stepping through each of those particular areas, we built Passport in a way that we want to make sure that we have an aggregator of those different methods.
Okay.
So now in this particular case, oh, the fourth is KYC, obviously. So if you trust a government agency that's issuing the credential, you can go through and trust that there's a real human behind that as well. So the ability to create a wallet on a face scan, I think, is one way that we're approaching. The ability to prove unique humanity simply by on-chain interactions or perhaps through verification of other mechanisms. Like, we want to make sure that we're reaching out and hitting people where they are and giving them the ability to prove their unique humanity that is both non-doxing, doesn't cost them anything potentially as well, And just offers that proof that they can take that forward into the rest of the ecosystem and leverage across a lot of other places that, you know, in this case, Human Passport's been integrated with.
That's strong. I understand that then. Like, that's kind of another Web3 principle, is not being tied into, say, one way of doing something, having options, being able to distribute it across multiple paths. So you talked there about how to link an individual to this key, the private key, right? And then the next step is, you know, anyone can link anything to a key. How do I actually link that to humanity? How do I link that to a verifiable credential? What's the step there? Do you have, like, again, many different providers, many different issuers? Can you talk a little bit to that?
Yeah. So for those that are creating keys, you can acquire a human passport either with the wallet, human wallet that we have, or any other wallet in this case. And whenever you go through and sort of prove your unique humanity, we still use very basic, like, DIDs, verifiable credentials, VCs that are set up. One of the reasons why we're so excited about the combination with Holonym is because of the addition of zero-knowledge proofs and sort of ZK nullifiers on those credentials themselves, which helps encrypt and protect that credential information that much more. In this particular case, we have 35 million, roughly, credentials that have been assigned. One thing that's fantastic about this is these are all user-generated themselves. So we're not going out and just creating these. Users are actually showing up to create them themselves. But it's through this model that they're able to go through and pick the ways that they want to self-identify to sort of prove unique humanity and take that forward using a scoring mechanism to whatever ecosystem it is that has sort of integrated Passport.
Okay. So on the scoring system, what kind of use cases are you seeing? You said 35 million verifiable credentials. Where is it being applied to mostly? When I think of digital identity, I typically think of the issuer, the holder, and then the verifier. What kind of verifiers are you seeing in the setup?
Yeah. A lot of this are other ecosystems and communities. The most common use cases are airdrops.
Okay.
So there's a whole business around sort of helping understand who's a real human on an airdrop list and participating in a community.
So it's like Sybil resistance, basically. Is that the killer use case for this?
Yes. Okay. Yep. That's one of the easiest, and it's the most common.
Okay, good.
I think we have others that have been really creative and are starting to explore just on-chain interactions as well. So you have the ability to hit an API, RESTful API, it's super performant. You can understand, you know, a score of a wallet address. One thing that's rather novel, though, is using the Ethereum Attestation Service, or EAS, users can go through and publish a score, and that brings smart contract to smart contract interactions to fruition. So there's a layer two that we're working with who are making all gas fees free for real humans on their network. We're still testing it with them on their testnet right now. But the expectation is like, let's let some of the automated arbitrage bots go through and drive fees on that sequencer fees while we enable a space for real humans to transact and interact where it doesn't actually cost them anything. Similarly, there's a prototype we were doing with Shapeshift, which is a DeFi exchange as well. They're looking at subsidizing swap fees for those that are real humans. Once again, all provable with just on-chain interactions. And so there's no intermediary. As soon as that's live, you can take advantage of that because that's something that happens at the actual DEX, like the liquidity pool level itself.
Got you. I mean, I'm very glad you specifically called out bots, fake users. It's something that's prevalent in crypto. I think some networks are actually quite pro to it as well because it boosts their transaction volume.
That's
it looks
exactly
good.
Right, yeah.
It's bonkers, right?
Yeah.
It is bonkers.
Right. I mean, they're looking for transaction throughput because then investors get excited. They're looking for TVL, and so just washing TVL through the thing. There's been a number of jokes about one dev that sort of builds up five DEXs that all just arbitrage against each other.
Yeah.
But because it's a single person, there's not a lot of money they're actually losing per se.
And these big investors don't know that, do they? They don't understand this stuff. So they're like, oh, the transactions look good. That's all I care about right now. I mean, this whole topic is a constant pull between UX and security/performance, something like this. So, are you noticing that when you've deployed these, is there any, kind of resistance to the UX, say, barriers to entry? Are people actually, I don't want additional kind of steps to get involved in these airdrops? Is that something you've noticed or not?
I would say for sure, yeah. I mean,
yeah.
Kyle, yeah, please.
There's, anytime we engage with an ecosystem, we're very fortunate we got to help Story with their airdrop. The Story team's absolutely fantastic. If you haven't had a chance to check out their network and sort of the IP that they're trying to give, democracy and ownership back to, certainly do that. But the IP, or the, excuse me, the Story team was very much in tune with, okay, we have X million of wallet users. We kind of expect, maybe single digit, very low double digit. These are real humans. Like, they just, they got it. Like, they've been in this space, and I was like, oh, hallelujah. Versus these other people, it's like, well, we have 35 million wallet addresses. We're thinking we need to airdrop to 30 million of those. And it's like, how many people are in crypto? Like, how many do you actually think are doing this?
But it's a dilution of value, right? Because there are some real users who aren't bots. And if you're saying putting 30 million airdrops out, like, if you're the normal person, just one individual, is getting a percentage of that, and that is, it's not good for the network, and they should see that. Sure, short term, it looks great to have these massive transaction volumes, but long term, you're not going to get real adoption, and eventually these bots are going to just disappear.
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. There's a sense of like, okay, I have maybe five or less wallets, and I've been sort of farming, exploring, doing my best to take a part in this ecosystem. That's very different from someone who has 20 plus, 100 plus, 500 plus, that's sort of just automating, scripting, running some guide over and over again.
Today's episode is sponsored by the VeChain Foundation.
Now, we often talk about how emerging technologies like blockchain have the potential to revolutionize sustainability. And VeChain is at the forefront of this green movement with initiatives like VBetterDAO. Let's take a closer look.
Imagine tracking small actions, like recycling, at low cost, making them valuable assets. These verified records build a massive collective impact, benefiting people through their own actions. Sound a bit complex, but VeChain made it fun. Explore our apps at vbetter.com.
VeChain's goal is to power a new era of sustainable solutions. So if you've got an app idea or just want to earn rewards for small, sustainable actions every day, go check out vbetterdao.com to find out more. And now, back to the show.
So there's this ability to go through and sort of prove you need humanity on those wallets.
Yep.
Even with human passport, most people are able to do that if they are in the space quite regularly across maybe a couple different wallets.
Okay.
And that's healthy because we each have different personas or ecosystems we interact with. I have my regen wallet that I do a bunch of grants and things like that with.
Yep.
I've got my DGEM wallet and my NFT wallet. And like these are things that like I am Anon on a couple of these wallets, and I do enough in the ecosystem where I can prove you need humanity across them. But I'm clearly not out there just like attacking these things to extract value for very minimal effort.
I like that you how you defined it there, because I think when most people think of digital identity, they think, okay, every single thing I do is going to be on chain for the world to see. And I think like we're seeing like W3 standards that are slowly becoming more and more concrete, is that the idea of different profiles. I can have a gaming profile and that you can only see that, and then I can have an educational profile and my DGEM profile, whatever it is, and there's a like very specific hub that, and I can choose who sees that data when I want them to see it. It's very specific. It's like the example they always compare it to is cash. Like it's private but not anonymous, is that the right term, I think? So like you know, the only people involved in that transaction know what I'm sharing, and that's it, which is quite an important thing, especially in like the digital age. I like that you keep mentioning humanity. We're at ETH Denver. Every other stall I see has got AI in some form or format. Is it something you guys are asked about a fair bit, the idea of AI agents? Like, because you've got very specifically gone down the humanity kind of protocol, that's the naming convention. Are you thinking about know your agent and this kind of stuff? That's a term that I've seen more and more.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. I think like, there's definitely this overwhelming tsunami of AI this, AI that. We have like people saying, you know, we need to build for the AI future, and you know, how do you do AI? So that's interesting. I mean, like AI, whatever that means, right? Like everyone calls, you know, it's like, is it an LLM or is it an AI? Whatever that is, but. I think what's going to be really interesting is the actual proliferation of agents and how they interact with people. And specifically how you might have, I kind of think of it as like a Napoleonic organization where you might have a core of agents. You'll have a trading agent, a translation agent, an order your food agent, etc. And there's going to be some free market for these types of services, and we'll see what happens, right? Whether it consolidates into one service or whether there'll be specialization. Now, if we want to be able to interact with a free market of agents, a decentralized system would probably be preferable if the consumer is going to win out in the end. Otherwise, we'll end up with like an Amazon type situation, and you have to funnel these services through one provider, and that might be less than ideal, especially when we're putting the entire world economy on these rails, right?
Yeah, yeah.
We don't want a singular economy. That's very bad. So if that happens, right, one thing that'll be, I think, very important is one, privacy and shared state across agents. So how do you have private shared state? Well, actually, MPC networks plus blockchain are really great for that. you can have agents that are posting perhaps like something called zero knowledge proofs on chain that they've accomplished some action or computed some task, and they can prove provenance of, you know, passing data from one provider to the other, to eventually submitting your Grubhub order or something, you know, after like predicting what you wanted to eat and when you wanted it. So if that happens, if that actually scales up, what are we going to see in terms of block space? Will block space become a premium? Are we just going to see block space filled up by a bunch of requests from AI agents, and you're just a human now? Are you actually going to interact with blockchains? Are you actually going to submit a transaction on an L1? Or is it you just interact with an agent and transacts with you? I think that's a big open question. If we still expect humans to need blockchains for coordination, and maybe like we don't want to always have to interact through intermediaries when like human to human is still valuable, perhaps not human to agent to human. Then human-centric blockchains, I think, are going to be very valuable in proof of humanity, being able to access block space as a commodity that's prioritized towards humans, I think might be very interesting, very valuable in the future.
I've seen more and more people arguing that, you know, Web3, everyone always says Web3 has this problem with UX and people, you know, onboarding the next billion users and whatnot. And I've actually seen it a few times now, people saying AI is going to solve that problem. You don't need to have a UX anymore. It's like the LLMs will solve it. You just interact with the agent. The agent handles all the stuff underneath. It's like the killer use case of blockchain technology is AI. Which I think it's fascinating. I do think that as agentic AI kind of takes off, they are going to need strong payment rails. Like, there's no way they're going to be transacting in fiat currency. That's just impossible. And when you're talking about these open worlds you described there, decentralized identity is key. Is it something on your roadmap you're thinking about? Like, how you link AI attributes potentially to private keys and give them, you know, the ability to interact in open world? Is something that's being thought about?
Yeah. So many years ago, I was at this company called Twitter, which has now been rebranded and taken over by someone else. And whenever I was there, we were experimenting with this concept of like labeling bots, like having people know who was a bot on platform and who wasn't.
Yeah.
And what that did was that actually built more trust. Like, you started to understand, like, oh, this is a bot. Like, I'm totally okay with interacting with this because I know it's a bot, as opposed to, like, oh, like, is this a real human? Is this not a real human? I could imagine we start to see a lot of that with this agentic future as well. Not only is there now a rush to build, you know, AI L2s so that all these AIs can start to interact with one another and sort of transact in the way that you're talking about, because doing that on like, current financial rails is just going to be a disaster. Like, the time it takes for things to process and whatever that might be. I think one of the things that sort of I would circle back to is, like, how do you continue to build trust through those interactions? So yes, we've been asked, like, hey, in addition to Sybil, can you help us label, like, these AI bots versus real humans? And it's like, well, we likely could, but, like, each of the transaction history is a thing that you have to sort of do the analysis on.
Okay.
And so as each of these agents take action, if it's in repeatable ways, that's very, very easy to classify after the fact.
Okay.
But I think some of the real value is going to come from, like, the self-labeling, like trying to give wallets this sort of domain space, the ENS, like whatever it is that you want to do that sort of says, like, hey, this is an agent. And I actually trust that more as a result than, like, me wondering whether or not there's an agent behind it.
I get you.
One thing I want to definitely kind of just add to this topic, I think it's very important, is let's go back to social. Like, I think social was the very kind of a big paradigm shift in culture and society and how we communicate information. And it's like the future of democracy, right? You know, it's like how we interact and decide things together. Now, what's interesting is, you know, a lot of social protocols just built out what people wanted. They built out ways for people to connect, for advertisers to access audiences, for messages to propagate through networks. And that's great. That sounds like, you know, amazing when you're building that. You know, you're just like a, you know, in your dorm room and you're making Facebook, right? Like, yeah, let's do this. We're going to save the world. But what's interesting is that this is, social is a complex, it's a complex system. And you have all of these emergent phenomena that come out of it and adversarial kind of game theoretic equilibria that emerge with stakeholders you never designed the system for, like the Cambridge Analyticas of the world. So one thing about social, and, you know, we still have this issue, and I feel like, you know, sometimes I see my feed and I'm like, is somebody listening to me? Why am I getting these things? Or why is this information being put? Why am I feeling this way? I feel less in control of my life because I'm being prompted with certain types of information. So there's this kind of like latent structure that's emerged from the game theory that's surrounding social. Now, enter AI agents, right? So this is much more, it has the same information propagation properties of social, but with the effect of direct causality, where an agent can actually affect something in the world by measuring something in the world, reasoning about it, and then responding to it. You're actually putting causality, at least in the digital sphere, and it's much more structured. So how can you, and if you're aware of that, that's like, oh, holy crap, that's like really bad. That's really dangerous. So you might ask, okay, well, how can I audit this agent? Or how can I trust this agent? How do I know it's actually doing what it's supposed to be doing? Things like global private shared state and blockchains and ZK and ZK compute and all these things are really useful. But if people are going to be interacting with agents that are going to do things on their behalf, I think it's really important to anchor that agent's capacity or responsibility in that human, where we have accountability that roots back to the human. So this idea of delegating your personhood, of allowing an agent to represent you and maybe delegate attributes of yourself or rights that come with your personhood in whatever social contract you enter, whether it's with the U.S. government or with a DAO. And so if that's happening, right, an AI agent's going to start like using your likeness to transact and do stuff like that, you know, that's where key infrastructure becomes really important. And something we're thinking a little bit about is how the architecture of the human wallet, and actually it already has AI embedded within it for transaction simulation, where you split the key. So you create the human key from your human attribute. You can prove personhood. You can do all these things. And then you split the key into two pieces. One you keep for yourself. The other you hand over to the agent. And then the agent has these kind of like hard-coded, very difficult to, you know, almost immutable policies or parameters. And there's like a whole like decentralized network that's computing those parameters, coming to consensus that those parameters are being reached. And then the agent has these guardrails. It goes off, you know, you give it the other piece of the key. It runs off. It like, you know, transacts within the limits that you set for those policies. But as soon as it comes into a point where it starts deviating from those policies, like don't spend more than $1,000 per day, don't interact with high-risk contracts, don't send money to the Lazarus Group in North Korea, please don't do that. Once that occurs, then the network will actually require user consent, right? So you're like, okay, well, I should pay attention to this. I'm going to flag this transaction, and I'm not just going to put this on autopilot and just let this do whatever it needs to do. So this idea of kind of using AI to give people situational awareness so you understand what each transaction means, but also to automate the kinds of things that you want to do online, but without giving complete power to this agent that's taking your delegated personhood to do things with.
I like that. I've actually not heard that point before. I've heard the idea of, you know, billions of agents just completely on their own, independently do whatever they want. And you're like, well, how do you interact with that? And I think, yeah, decentralized identity, sure, you can start to have like people reviewing them, rating them, whatever, and maybe that can help to a degree. But linking them back to a human always, so there's a degree of accountability. If something goes wrong, then that person is held accountable for that. I think it's quite powerful. I've actually not heard that point before, so you heard it here first. Nice one. I'm glad you talked about trust and the Lazarus Group. So something that everyone's constantly talking about is the, you know, what happened with Bybit and all this kind of stuff. But to bring it back to what you guys are doing, could you kind of talk me through how Holonym's identity system could have, you know, improved wallet security generally, maybe how it could have helped with that situation, if it could have, just to bring it back to the users so they understand the value of what you guys are doing?
Yeah, sure. So the Bybit hack was like almost admirably sophisticated in the way they approach. I don't know that our systems would have done anything other than perhaps help them with some of the blind signing and like the ways that interaction through Safe. Safe transactions are often very large, depending on the amount of signers and the types of things you're trying to transfer. So blind signing is one of the pieces that I think was at play there. And so some of the types of wallet stuff we're doing, I think, will help with that in the future. Much of that particular approach, I think, on like from our perspective in the identity space, we are helping make sure that like the Lazarus Group has a hard time offboarding that funding.
Okay.
Right. So in this case, like because all of the transactions on blockchains are visible, like you can track a lot of that funding after the fact. It's, okay, where is this going? How's this being spent? What's happening with it? And there's all sorts of rumors already flying about like, oh, they're like bridging over here and they're buying NFTs over here and they're swapping this and they're doing that. And it's like, maybe. But I don't think it's happening because of just the quantities that was hacked, like at any sort of clip that they can offboard that particular funding right now. Some of where we've been focused, though, is on this concept of proof of clean hands. So making sure that the people you're interacting with have clean hands or are not a part of North Korea, some other sanctioned nation. And so this is a thing that we're doing on Aztec Bridging, I think is one of the first. So working with different networks to make sure that those that are bringing funds onto their network are not actually from the Lazarus Group.
Okay.
And that there's proof of their sort of like clean hands, like their good citizenship inside of the world is coming on, that doesn't require them to always dox themselves as well.
So is that mostly asset tracking on chain? You can like create like a risk score type for per address? Is that how it works roughly? Or
Yeah.
So it's interesting. I really wish our co-founder Nanak was here because he was at the Ledger offices, I think like 3 weeks ago, and did a podcast, I think, with one of the Starknet community folks. And in it, he's like, hey, guys, you know, I'm here. Like, you know, I have this platform. I really want to just say, like, I'm like paraphrasing him, right? But, you know, he's like, I really want to say that, hey, like, there's a huge vulnerability in the safe front end right now. And our company doesn't, you know, we're not using our safe except in an air gap system with like a Chromebook with like minimal surface attack area for bots. Like, there's a huge attack vector. But we're working on something that could potentially mitigate this attack vector, especially when it's combined with the Ledger for blind signing. So he was like saying that 3 weeks ago. Interestingly enough, Marana Ventures, who is a spin, you know, it's propped up by Bybit founders. They were looking at this about a year ago. We were developing this. We were trying to tell them about it. And so, you know, we're like, oh, no, guys. No.
One email. Told you so.
Yeah. We're like, okay, so we might be fundraising soon. just kidding. No, it sucks what happened.
It's crazy. Wow.
So the way it works, actually, it's very similar to the 2PC. It's called 2PC MPC. It's how I was describing the AI agent key splitting, except what we do, so we have that one shard of the key, and then the other key is put in, right now it's a trusted execution environment, sorry, I have a phone call. Phone really quick.
Do a hard pause. That's the beauty of not doing it live. Like, all this is fine.
Okay, cool.
And your question might have been closer to, like, passport scores and how we're keeping track of scores
it,
as well.
It is, definitely.
Yeah. So, like, the going into that side, I think, is good, but making the delineation between humanity versus proof of clean hands, like, proof of clean hands doesn't require this.
A score, yeah, that's what I was going to get to eventually. So, for example, what proof of clean hands does is it allows you, and this is really important in the case of the Aztec Bridge, it lets you bridge, say, Ethereum from, you know, ETH from Ethereum onto Aztec, unlock privacy, but you have to do a zero-knowledge identity proof first. So this means going through ZKKYC, you know, either you tap your passport on your phone if you're a privacy maxi, then you do, like, you know, client-side liveness detection, and then you can mint that proof, or you just do the traditional, like, you know, spin up with Verif, and then they're blinded to who you are. So once you process, you know, complete that, you then do something called a verifiable proof of encryption. So then that data is then encrypted to a node or a network, and there's proof within the zero-knowledge proof of that you've completed KYC that you've encrypted that data. So it's proof of data availability. Now, how do you... No, that's the first part. So the second part is how do you actually know when to decrypt that data? So say, for example, there's a hack that occurs and people want to, law enforcement comes to your bridge or comes to your protocol or your dApp or whoever, and they say, hey, we need the information because this might be funding nuclear weapons development. You're like, oh, shit, okay, well, I didn't consider that. But if you're using proof of clean hands, what you can do is actually have conditions that are either on-chain, right? So you could say... like, for example, you could have a rate limit as to how many times somebody decrypts data, or you could have, for example, we could use a service like Predicate, which is an Oracle service that has, like, this embedded logic in it and can produce signatures if conditions are met. Yeah. So you could say, okay, well, if an address appears in 2 out of the 5 blacklists that's operated by independent agencies, that can act as a trigger condition to then request the decryption from whatever node or network that's storing that data. So that's one way that we can maintain what we call transparent accountability for these edge cases. But once you produce this proof, you can then mint on Aztec clean ETH or clean BTC. And that's a token standard that's only possible to create if you've passed the sanctions check and proven that. Now, there's tons of problems with what happens once you're an Aztec, because you can mint clean ETH and then pass it to somebody else who hasn't done it.
And then what happens then? Does it all of a sudden the standard drops and it's no longer potentially clean ETH, or how does it work?
That's the $1 billion question. Yeah. So we're trying to figure that out. I really wish our girlfriend Ananak is here, but he's working on like how you can have... Aztec has a very different architecture where you can do a lot of client-side computation on transactions referencing on-chain history. So the validators or the node doesn't actually need to like do the computation for you. So you can do this thing where you like unroll your past transaction history and then produce ZK proofs that you've like interacted with this in the past. But it's very complicated.
It's tricky, right? If it was a UTXO-based, it'd be fine because you just track the UTXO forever. But because it's address-based, everything kind of gets mixed at every single transaction, so it's a bit messier. I can understand now why that's a complicated question
to
ask.
It's super hard, yeah.
So airdrops. Airdrops is the big thing right now. But you know, digital identity and strong digital identity standards being like used in the normal world has so many use cases. I've seen some of the stats are it could save like 5 to 15% of GDP, even in the Western world. What are some of the killer use cases you guys are hoping for, maybe even outside of crypto, that normal everyday users will understand?
Yeah, on the identity side. I think there's a lot of experimentation that we're still happening. One of the things that I am personally... get excited about is sort of digital, like financial sovereignty in digital spaces. So that just means being able to own your own money. Some aspects of it are libertarian. You don't have to believe in being a libertarian so much from the aspect of like, I only worry about myself. But I think we do want to see more and more people are empowered like financially, where they can't get debanked or assets can't sort of be withheld from them if they want to boycott something. In this particular space, this is where I think digital identity, proving that someone's a unique human, giving them sort of power to interact in these ecosystems where we can't actually censor the type of monetary actions they can take, is really, really valuable. So there was this concept called Operation Choke Point, which is somewhat popular inside the US, where they're trying to like debank a bunch of people. A lot of crypto founders I know have also been kicked off of banks like Chase and Wells Fargo and others.
I have a funny anecdote with that too as well.
Yeah.
So when we closed our seed round, we diversify our banks, you know, well before the Silicon Valley Bank implosion wouldn't have affected us. We diversify our banks. And one of them is a traditional brick and mortar bank called PNC out of Pittsburgh. So somehow, I guess they got on the press wire. They're like, oh, like one of our banking company, you know, one of the companies that's banking with us raised a round. And they didn't really look much into it. So then they reached out. They were like, hey, you know, we're super excited to help you guys, you know, make sure you put those funds that you've raised into the PNC bank account. And let's, you know, we have all sorts of great financial products for you guys and all sorts of services. We can help you out with automated bills, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh, thank you so much. Yeah, we're super excited. You know, we're as a, you know, identity company and, you know, we're really excited to bring crypto to the masses. And they're like, wait, you're a crypto company? And they're like, oh, sorry, we can't service you. And then I responded to them. I was like, wait, so does this mean you're closing our account?
Wow.
And then they just never responded. Yeah, which is like, I'm like, all right, let's just see how long this keeps going then. I mean,
Transition we've seen over the last few years.
That was 8 months ago.
8 months ago that was. Wow, that is unbelievable. So on the future and stuff, is there any announcements you guys want to make about the roadmap coming out? I know I mentioned earlier on that you didn't have a coin and now... Follow on.
Yeah. Well, we still don't have a coin. we haven't launched anything in the last 40 minutes of the discussion here. One of the things that I think is really important to us is we are starting to build a bit more of our community focused around just human flourishing. This idea that like we want humans to sort of take over and be the ones that are front and center on a lot of these ecosystems, blockchains, crypto networks that are out there. So nothing quite to announce yet as far as what that means, but I think there's a lot that we have now with human protocol, like human network going live, ways that we want to include the community inside of governance for that. And one of the first is part of what our manifestation campaign is. I feel like, Shada, you might be the best suited to talk a little bit about that.
This is what I'm absolutely just like obsessed with and excited about right now. So we're performing this campaign for human alignment around technology. So how do we build humanistic technology and basically like nucleate a core group of invested community members that are going to take some of these primitives that we've built and allow and apply them to other use cases, right? So the way that we're thinking about it is we're going to initialize this community with a covenant. So a covenant is an agreement. It's basically like a commitment that you're going to all do something together. Now, what blockchains are really good for is actually enforcing commitments. And our challenge with this campaign, actually, is taking very low-level commitments that nodes are committing to do something that they said they're going to do, to create a key, for example, and then bubbling that up all the way up to what digital rights look like on the internet. So some of these things are obvious, for example, right? Like nodes could be running under crypto economic incentives to have commitments to provide personhood proofs for people. And because these nodes have these embedded incentives within them, they're very difficult to shut down, to take over, to revoke the service. So if you can get a proof of personhood from this network, what you've effectively done is taking a natural right, from like John Locke, Thomas Hobbes, these guys, of personhood, and putting that into actual commitments of code that are very difficult to just censor. So starting from that and starting from key custody and how key custody might be a modern day, I think, like a natural right that underpins or underscores really like all societies that might be operating in the digital world under a code of ethics. So we're inviting folks to build this co-participatory framework. And the idea is this covenant is going to be a web app that will release and you can actually commit to these high-level values by creating a human wallet on the fly, perfect onboarding, you don't even know it, cryptographically signing this, and then now you're part of the community. Now you can like signal these values, and we're thinking of ways as well to solicit types of contributions that allow us to build a cultural critical mass around human alignment, around technology.
Oh, that's incredibly exciting. Using this technology for good, which is not typically done in this space.
Right. Sure. Right. Yeah, the casinos are often sometimes hard, but it's unfortunately sometimes what's popular. So we're always happy to help the digital casino. If you're a project that's looking for help as you're rolling through the digital casino, let us know. Anti-Sybil is often helpful. But we definitely appreciate sort of the manifestation campaign and trying to make sure that we're catering more towards real humans in this approach.
Guys, thanks. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. I really appreciate it. We'll put all the links to the projects on the channel on the episode. So, yeah, thank you for joining us. I guess enjoy the rest of ETH Denver. And thank you to listening those wherever you may be. And join us next time to untangle a little more of Web3.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Untangling Web3.
Don't forget to send us your thoughts, questions, and comments on social media. And be sure to follow us on your favorite podcast provider to catch the next episode. See you next time to untangle a little bit more of Web3.
The views we express here are our own and do not reflect the views of our employers.